Hey, product people. Have you ever wanted to launch a successful Kickstarter, create your own web application, and write your own book? Well, you're going to love this episode because Tracy Osborne, today's guest, has done all three of those things. First, I think we need a little update from me, Justin Jackson, because it's been a while since we've had an episode. I just flew to Barcelona for MicroConf Europe. Mike and Rob invited me to speak. I opened up the conference there, and I just had an incredible time hanging out with all these folks from Europe that I've never met in person before. These are people that have been listening to this podcast since day one. These are people who have, you know, bought a lot of the things I've made. These are people who I've developed good friendships with just talking on email or on Twitter or in Slack. And it was just a pleasure to get to know them, to be able to talk to them face to face. My wife booked my travel for this trip, and I told her, you know, just book me 3 or 4 days for the conference and then I'll fly home. And she ended up booking me 12 days. She wanted me to go and enjoy, being in Barcelona. And, I was a little bit worried about that. I haven't taken a break in a long time. And sometimes I feel like, you know, if I stop working, slow down the train, that everything's going to kind of fall apart. And everything didn't fall apart. I took a lot of time off. I ended up hanging out with Mark Kuhlbrugge from Betalist almost every single day after the conference. We went in, we went to Sagrada Familia, which is that big, crazy cathedral. We went on a bunch of hikes. We took photos of us overlooking Barcelona. And it was just a very relaxing time. And I felt like I couldn't afford to take that much time off, especially with my book coming out, Marketing for Developers. I managed to get the beta out right before I left. There's about 70 people in the beta right now. And I'm hoping to have the final launch in October now. It's pushed out a little bit. Working on the video tutorials right now. If you want more information on that, justinjackson.ca/marketingfordevelopers. But anyway, I thought, man, I can't afford to take time off. And I'm just really glad I did. It was really great to just not think about work, to let my mind recharge. And I've been talking to a few folks since then, and a lot of people seem to have this strategy of taking time off, individually, even if you're married, to go off without your family and just have some time to renew yourself. One of my favorite moments of the trip was sitting in this coffee shop in Barcelona called Satan's Coffee and just reading these magazines. The coffee shop didn't have Wi-Fi, and so I was just reading these magazines and these interviews with interesting architects. I read an interview about Dan Wyden from Wyden and Kennedy, which is a big ad firm in Portland. So yeah, just an incredible time. Glad I'm back, getting back on the train and finishing off Marketing for Developers. I also have an announcement coming up for a new thing I'm working on that I'll probably release some things about it in October. That's all I'll say for now. It's another podcast, and in the vein of this podcast, Product People, and the other one I did, Build and Launch, it kind of incorporates both of those elements. All right. That is about 4 minutes of yakking from me, which is way too much. Let's get into this interview with Tracy Osborne. You're going to love it. Here it is. Tracy, why don't you give us a little bit of background on you? What have you been making lately? And, you know, how did that kind of all get started?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this kind of all started about 5.5 years ago. I was working at a startup, and it started in college. It was really cool. We were working in a garage, just a bunch of me and a bunch of dudes, and I was the designer. And I worked with them for 4.5 years. And after 4.5 years, I kind of learned everything I was going to learn at this startup, and realized that I kind of really wanted to not have a boss for a while. So as a designer, I quit and I started freelancing. I did freelancing over the summer. My husband was going through YC. And so I actually worked with a bunch of YC startups designing their websites, which was a good experience. Yeah. But it was
your husband is in this space as well.
Yeah. He works for himself as well. His YC company, he ended up leaving that company, but he started another company, which he then got acquired by Google. And then he left Google and now he's working on companies just, you know, with me as we travel.
Oh, so cool.
He's a cool inspiration. So he's been actually helping me a lot with all of this. Cause when he was in YC, I watched him go through that and I'm like, dude, that looks so cool. I want to be a startup founder as well. and freelancing was fun, but it was still like, as a designer, I had to go to these people and be like, hey, this is what I recommend. And they're like, nah. And I'm like, and it kind of drove me nuts. So I got into my head that I really, really, truly wanted to work for myself and build something and get into YC and all that.
Yeah. So you started off as a designer.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about that because if you look at Tracy's stuff, folks, if you go to Hello Web App or Wedding Lovely, it is very well designed.
Oh, thank you.
And the book itself just looks beautiful. So I was wondering, that was one of my questions, is did you do the design for that?
Yeah.
And you did. That's awesome. Okay.
Yeah. I have a kind of a tech background. I mean, I've been working on websites since I was 11, which is like 1995. My family has worked in tech. My uncle used to work at Apple. My grandfather worked at IBM. So I've always was around computers. I just started building HTML websites. And when I went to college, I thought, oh, I'm doing HTML websites. That obviously means I'm a programmer. And I went into computer science at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. And it was an awful experience. I'm not a computer science in a academic setting. With all the theory and everything just did not jive with me. And I did not learn, we were learning Java too, which is, I've heard is not the best for learning your first programming language on. So I had this awful experience with one professor, which kind of led me to rage quitting. And I switch over to an art degree so I can do graphic design instead.
Interesting. Can we stop right there for a second? Because obviously women in tech is a topic that comes up quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, people are talking a lot about women in STEM and things like that. So what specifically about, was there anything specifically about the course? Like, did you feel like that was, the program was just more not for you? Or was there something about being a woman in that setting that was, you know, not working?
Yeah, I was lucky. There's a lot of other chicks in my classes with me, which is cool. I mean, it wasn't like 50-50. I want to say it was maybe 20-80 women in my classes. I don't want to say it was me because I'm such a visual person. Our school was on semesters and quarters. In second quarter, I took a class where we started learning GUIs. And I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. Like, this is really cool. I can like press a button and then write the thing to make the thing work.
Yeah.
But computer science is really not about that. It was like, you know, you get to know this. But then I moved into the third quarter. This was the awful class. And it was more about theory. Like a good half of the class, a half of the quarter was dedicated to a project where we had to go through sorting methods. We had to like reverse engineer sorting methods or something like that and write this whole paper on like why ones are better, ones aren't, and like how are we run these tests. And it was, I just bombed it. It was, I mean, for me, working with a real life application, which is why web programming really works well for me, when I can see the results live and work with customers, it's like everything started clicking at that moment. But computer science, that professor in that one class, I was not getting it. And I sent him an email about it. And he sent me back this rant saying how I never study, which is not true. About how I was being a terrible student and skating through life. I don't know why he did that. And it was the moment where I'm like, I can't be in computer science anymore. This guy is awful. So I want to go back to him and be like, hey, you thought I couldn't be a programmer. Look, I'm writing books about this. I fantasize about this.
Because that's pretty antagonistic on his half.
Horrible.
Yeah. And it's funny because that brings up, you know, a lot of questions about, you know, like what is programming and what's required to become a programmer?
Yeah.
And actually, that would be interesting to know, like, in terms of theory, how did you approach theory in your book?
Not really.
you find like it's just really about the hands-on, like building.
Yeah.
The thing.
Well, my goal with the book was basically a lot of other programming books, they throw in the theory. And I feel like for a person who's not a programmer that's jumping into programming for the first time, like me in college, they need to see the actual results about what's going on. And theory can come in like step two. But step one is to get that moment of success. Like, this is what we're doing. And yeah. then you can build that in afterwards. So in my book, I very much avoid a lot of technical explanations. I don't want to say dumb it down because it's not dumbed down, but it's definitely to real words. I don't use acronyms. I don't try to throw in fancy pants words. I try to be really goofy in the book to make it seem more real, like more friendly. And, you know, it's just, I hope that, you know, the book will get people inspired and say, oh, this is what it can be like. And if they want to be an engineer and they need to know that theory and they need to know some of that really deep dive information, then they can learn after that. But it's definitely, the book is just literally like step one to deployment of building a web app.
Yeah. And I was reading some of your stuff, and I think a lot of people can identify with this. You said you're reading other tutorials and there was things that just, you're like, why are they explaining it that way?
Yeah.
Can you think of an example of a way, you know, that it was being explained one way and you decided to explain it another way?
Yeah. The big thing right now in Django is class-based views. Okay. And, you know, and it's for excellent programmers, class-based views where you can like make a piece of code that is so reusable and you can just tie it into a billion places and makes your code like so efficient. My husband often says to me when I'm talking about how to do something, he's like, oh yeah, you can do that in like five lines, you know, because that's like the big thing you do. You have to like cut it down to like the most perfect little piece of code.
Yeah.
I feel very strongly that does not work for a beginner. Hello Web App is taught, I guess, function-based views where like literally it's like a view per page kind of, and it just, you know, top down in the code walks you through everything that's happening. So the code is not efficient. It's not pretty. Yeah. And this is still the code I use for Wedding Lovely. It made sense to me to write it this way. It means that when I need to figure out what's going on, I don't have to like think really hard about like what's tying in and what's going to break if I change one thing that's tied to five other things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's, you know, other beginner tutorials for Django still to this day that are just like class-based views are the way to go. And I'm just like, I totally disagree with that.
Yeah.
Hello Web App teaches Django web app programming. It doesn't necessarily teach Python. And so like the first chapter says, hey, if you're learning Python, I recommend a few resources, including Zed Shaw's Learn Python the Hard Way.
All right. I want to go back a little bit and talk about how you promoted the book, because, it sounds like an interesting kind of timeline. I don't know a lot. I know that you started with Kickstarter and then you went from there. So maybe just walk me through, you know, you had the idea and then what happened next?
The first thing I did was actually reached out to a few publishers just so I can have that idea if publishers would think it would be interesting. I reached out to my ideal publisher in the whole world, which is A Book Apart. That they do a lot of books for designers. And I was thinking, Django for designers, because they have like HTML5 for designers. Like Django for designers, this will totally fit in. I sent over, I think I wrote something like 3,000 words, like the basic introduction to the book.
Yeah.
And I sent it over to the editor, and the editor's like, this is too big of a scope. And I'm like, no, the book is going to be the size of your books. I'm pretty sure I can do that. And I, you know, this is pretty small. And
yeah, it looks like a Book Apart book.
Yeah, it was really my inspiration. Seriously, my idols. Mm. But there was no way I can convince her of that until I had the book completely finished. So they turned me down. And I ended up talking with No Starch Press, which has all of their royalties online. And they accepted the book. They told me they would accept it. But the royalties were like, I'm going to screw this up. But it was something like $8,000 advance for 10% royalties or something like that.
Wow. Okay.
Which is actually fairly standard in the industry.
Yeah.
And I was looking at that and I'm like, okay, I could do that and have an $8,000 advance, or I could work with Kickstarter and get that advance, because I went through design school and I have editorial design experience. And so a lot of the things that the publisher would give me, which would be, you know, formatting a book, actually, I'd probably be more irritated if someone else was formatting it than I was, because I'd be really opinionated. I wanted to do that anyways. So decided that Kickstarter, you know, hopefully would be the way to go, and hopefully would get funded. So that's how I got to that decision.
That's awesome. Did you use that that idea of, you know, I could go to a publisher and get an advance, or I could go to Kickstarter? Did you ever use that as a way to promote the Kickstarter?
Yeah, I didn't really use it as a way to promote Kickstarter. The biggest thing with Kickstarter was actually I launched it in time for PyCon Canada.
Yeah.
So this was last summer. And I have a lot of friends in the Python community already. I was actually giving a tutorial on what I was hoping to have the content on. The book wasn't written, but the tutorial was called Django for Designers. I was getting a tutorial there.
Okay.
So I got to test out the writing, the material I had. And then throughout the tutorial, I was like, support my Kickstarter. And then I'd be at the conference and I'd find like the big wigs that have the $8,000 or 8,000 Twitter followers. And I'd be like, tweet out my Kickstarter. And I basically just ran from person to person getting
wow.
people to promote the Kickstarter.
So you were doing some hustle. Like you went to the conference and you were going up to people.
Luckily, they're mostly my friends and they mostly knew of me already. So it made it easier. It wasn't like complete strangers off the block. Be like, hey, you don't know me. But I could be like, hey, remember me? Now I have a Kickstarter and you really should tweet this out.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that's actually a topic I bring up in the book. How did you build those relationships? How did they kind of know who you were before PyCon?
I love the Python community, and you know, I don't know about much about other communities, but when I first started learning Python, it helped that my husband does Python as well. He's a contributor to a lot of big Python projects, including, I guess technically he's a contributor to requests because he wrote an underlying library that requests use, which is a really big library in Python.
Oh, cool.
So he does know a lot of people in Python. So when I said, hey, I'm going to learn Python as well, I got access to a few people. But then we can start talking about Wedding Lovely, let's tie it in. When I first saw Wedding Lovely, I wrote a few articles on learning, or how was the order of this? I wrote an article about finding a co-founder.
Okay.
And I was like, I'm quitting my job and I'm running I want to launch this website and want to find a co-founder. This is before I decided to learn how to program. And I actually got a ton of upvotes on Hacker News. And I got a ton of Twitter followers because of this post, which is really strange. I don't think a post like that would ever get anywhere near the top on Hacker News nowadays.
Yeah.
So I had some Python resources, but my husband does not do Django whatsoever. And I knew I needed to do Django because I needed all that stuff that's built into it for beginners.
Yeah.
So I tweeted out being like, hey, I'm learning Django. Does anyone have resources, whatnot? And a few people were like, hey, I would totally love to help you out. People I never met before, which was super cool.
Wow. So
Kenneth Love, he's a big, he works a lot with Django. He's currently in Portland. He was running some tutorials online, like blog. It was like learn how to make a blog, which I eventually used to build Wedding Lovely. I got him on IM and I was able to ask him questions, really stupid questions. And then I met another person in the Bay Area, just randomly met up at a co-working space and he walked me through the major things in Django, like Django packages and Pinax and all these other things that are built on Django to help out for beginners.
Yeah.
So the community definitely, I had some Twitter followers and I was really lucky to have the community reach out to me to help out.
Yeah. Although it also seems like you were willing to ask for help.
Yeah, I love bootstrapping off other people.
Yeah.
You know, because there's people, everyone's smarter than me. I kind of feel like that sometimes. And, you know, it works for Wedding Lovely. When I ask for help with marketing and SEO and everything like that, people love being opinionated. You can tweet it out and people are like, rah, this is the way you do it. I'm like, all right, check. You know, there's one answer I have. It definitely helped out for the book, you know, asking people for help with promotion. It's bootstrapping off other people, not taking advantage, but, you know, being willing to ask for help has been such a boon over the last 5 years for both of my ventures.
Yeah. And it sounds like that's how you were able to build a lot of those relationships is mm-hmm. to ask for help. And maybe that's even, that's counter to some of our natural instincts, which is to want to appear like you're in control and maybe to appear like you are in more control than you really are.
Yeah. Sometimes it's not just asking for help. It's something, sometimes it's just saying what's going on. Like being honest about your experiences, like some things for Wedding Lovely, I've written some posts about things I wish I did differently, marketing and all that, which does, people like reading about that. I like being honest about my experiences because Wedding Lovely hasn't been a runaway success. You know, it's kind of, it's been in the middle, which has been, you know, enough to keep it running, but not enough that I can get funding for it or, you know, hire a bunch of employees. Yeah. So I like to talk about the things like why I think that's happened. Talk about the troubles I'm having, and people do reach out on their own without you necessarily asking directly for help.
Yeah. And that vulnerability is interesting.
Well, it's kind of the women in tech thing. It's the being self-deprecating, which I get in trouble with all the time because I'll have some meetings with some awesome people and I'll be like, they'll be like talking about Wedding Lovely. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's terrible. Like that's what I do. I'm like, oh, Wedding Lovely is not a runaway success. I always do that. And it's not always a good thing because I have to be like, hey, Wedding Lovely has made, I look on Stripe and it'll be like $50,000 that I've accumulated the last 4 years, which is peanuts for startups, but it's a huge amount of money. Sometimes I feel like I've conned it out of people.
Well, and it's a huge amount of money if you looked at every startup ever created and how many of them are still at revenue zero.
Yeah.
That's a huge amount of money. But so, I think the vulnerability is still like the most successful interviews I've done, the most successful blog posts I've done is when, for whatever reason, I just felt like, oh, okay, I'll just let people know what it's really like. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe you can overdo it, but more often than not, I think vulnerability and just saying, this is what happened and this is what I learned from it, that's interesting to people.
Yeah, one of the things I hate most about startup founders when I've run into people like this is the people where everything is amazing. And it's just like, they're awesome. They're killing it. Nothing is going wrong. They're going to be like, you know, rocket ship to the moon next week. And it's exhausting. And you know, that's not right. You know, that's their personality. Just like brag, brag, brag. Everything is amazing. And especially for startups, it's probably not amazing. It's probably like they go home in the open corner. Cause that's what I do, you know?
Yeah. Really hard. Yeah.
And it's just kind of exhausting to hear that. People like to hear the real stories. And that has also helped me with Wedding Lovely. I work with small businesses. And when I send out emails to them being honest, like, hey, I'm just, you know, I'm one person working from home. I'm building this website to help you out. I just, you know, I'm really passionate about your business. And so it's like a me and it's what I'm working on. And I'm honest sometimes like, oh, I'm trying to get funding or things. I don't necessarily ever say things aren't going well because I don't want them to worry.
Yeah.
But it's more being human with them. And it's definitely helped out compared to, you know, some wedding startups out there, which are very corporate, they're very like, we're a big organization, blah, blah, blah. It's helping you stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, totally. You know who else does this that I love? And he's the one that kind of inspired me to try to be more like this is Nate Cotney. Do you know Nate Cotney?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Nate from the beginning was like, when he was running Draft, he was like, you know, here's me and my dog. And, you know, every time you pay for a Draft membership, it helps me feed my dog. And now, you know, he's working for essentially,
he's High Rise, right? Yeah.
But he just hired his wife as the chief operating officer.
I didn't know that.
And, you know, there's this transparency and personability about that, that I think a lot of other people would shy away from. Like,
I husband and I can work together.
Yeah. But, but even that he's sharing it like this, cause you know, it's like, well, if it's just a husband and wife, that makes it seem like not as professional or, you know, and I just love his personability, I think is the big thing.
Draft is still a great product, even though he's not 100% working on it. I use it for writing with Hello Web App.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I use it all the time too. That's awesome. So let's go back to that Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So you decided to do this Kickstarter serendipitously. Is that a word? Serendipitously?
Yes, I think so. Or at least it should be.
Feels like I'm saying it wrong. There's a Canadian.
I make up words all the time.
But, you know, you had this, you launched it and then you had PyCon at the same time.
Well, I launched it for PyCon. I launched it early because of PyCon. So it wasn't necessarily serendipitously.
Yeah, you planned it.
Yeah, it was, I moved it forward and it was kind of stressful because I had to get everything ready. And the book wasn't, you know, in any finished state in terms of the Kickstarter, but I was like, oh wait, this is such an opportunity that I need to, you know, move things around to make it happen.
Yeah. And did that really move the needle having all those people share it? Like, do you think that was a key to the success?
It's hard to tell, you know, what would happen if I didn't do it. You know, a lot of Kickstarter is kind of like the nice way of asking your friends for money.
Yeah.
which is a little like hurts a little bit. I'm like, oh, you know, support my Kickstarter. And then a friend sends over $50 and I'm like, oh, hi, thank you, friends. If I feel a little bad about that, I'm hoping strangers on the internet will take care of that for me.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely helped. I think a lot of Python, it's like, I don't know offhand exact numbers, but feeling wise, I want to say like 60% of the donations probably came from people in the Python community. They were super supportive. It wasn't like newbies looking for the book. It was people who wanted to support the book, even though they didn't need it.
Yeah.
Which was really awesome. I had a big contribution. I guess a sponsorship from a startup that was in the Django community, just wanted to reach other Django people. So there was that. There was the Python community. I did get a lot of backers through Kickstarter, which was cool. I think overall it was over 500 backers. But I think a lot of it was just like the support of the Kickstarter, support of the Python community, and ergo, you know, launching at PyCon really helped out with that.
Yeah, I love that story because I think the challenge we often have as makers is that we want to stay in our basement and build things. And this idea that you had to get out there and actually talk to people face to face. And maybe there's even some hesitancy to share what we're working on. And I think regardless of why people were supporting the Kickstarter, what I like about Kickstarter is that it's way different than taking angel money or venture money. It's like people are saying, like, I believe in this. And maybe the whole the whole job to be done is just that they want to have an investment in whatever the project is, right?
Yeah.
And to this day, people still, I mean, I've bought a lot of I bought both 37 Signals books just because I wanted to invest in the movement more than the content, you know? So there's always these other kinds of you know, jobs that people are kind of hiring products to do, or hiring, you know, in this case a Kickstarter sponsorship to do.
Yeah.
But meeting people face to face and saying, you know, I've got this idea to launch this book, what do you think? And then you can get their direct reaction.
It's more persuasive because I could send an email to that same person. Emails are so easy to ignore.
Yeah.
When you go up to them, you know, again, as a human, being like, hey, I have this Kickstarter, would love it if you could, you know, tweet it out. I think it's just vastly more likely that the person will go ahead and do that.
Yeah. And you can also get their direct feedback. Like you can read.
Yeah.
Because I wonder if it would have been different if you were talking about kickstarting Wedding Lovely.
Yeah, I probably would have. Because, being at PyCon, talking to Python people, working on a project that's going to be improving the Python ecosystem, essentially, is very aligned. Kickstarter for Wedding Lovely, that's such a fascinating idea. The wedding industry kind of drives me nuts because, I guess, working with, you know, developers and launching a book, marketing and running all of that has been so much easier than working in the wedding industry.
Yeah.
And the wedding industry is different because there's a billion and a half different wedding startups out there. They're all vying for attention because a lot of people jump into the industry thinking, oh, it's a wedding. As people are spending, you know, $28,000 on average on a wedding, I'll just launch my product and just rake in the cash, which doesn't happen at all.
Yeah.
And bloggers, there's so many bloggers out there, like you're trying to get your product out and get people talking about it. And bloggers just like, well, I'll talk about it if you pay me $100.
Yeah.
Sponsored posts are the way that they all make money.
Yeah.
Whereas the book was like, you know, I launched a book and people were excited about talking about it. You know, they didn't ask for money for me for, you know, putting it out there.
To talk about it.
And stuff like that. Yeah. So it was totally different. It's honestly more refreshing.
Yeah. Now you have a post. I didn't want to read it because I wanted to hear it from you. You said it was basically saying what you wish you would have done, or what you wish would have done with your Kickstarter campaign. So tell me, how did it go? Because it seems like you raised a fair amount of money. What would you do differently if you did it next time?
Yeah, I think it was the book of posts was like the book in general. I'm not sure. One of the biggest thing was launch on time. Kickstarter campaigns are often, they often run long and a lot of people are expect that. But there's some people who who support my campaign that had never supported a campaign before and was looking at it as like, we're ordering this and it's coming out on the date, which is my fault. I was actually a year delayed.
Okay.
Lots of I can probably fill up the rest of this podcast or this time here, telling you all the reasons why, but essentially it was a year late. And I would get emails like near daily from backers being like, "Hey, I don't understand what's going on, but I haven't gotten my book yet." And I'd be like, "Well, it's still being worked on. I'm sending updates like every 2 weeks, being like, this is what's going on."
Yeah.
The funny thing is that I just announced yesterday on Twitter, I'm actually working on a follow-up book.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's kind of scary. This time I'm actually finishing the book before the new Kickstarter comes out.
Interesting.
I haven't mentioned that yet, but I'll be doing another Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Just because printing a book costs me several thousand dollars, and that's pretty much the only way I can pay for printing the book is if I have some money on hand. So Kickstarter is kind of the way I can do that. So I'll be doing a Kickstarter again and kind of applying these lessons. So A is having the book finished, like the first draft finished before I run the campaign, because at least then I have a good idea in terms of how long it's going to take. Yeah. And I think I mentioned a few other things. Like one of them was a video. You want to be, a video is crucial. And I had that, and my video is professionally done by a friend of mine, which was awesome, who's a professional videographer.
Yeah.
But I was sitting, and every time I watch a video, I can't watch it because I'm just like leaning forward and I'm so static.
Yeah.
And I should have been standing and more alive. And I think that was one of the tiny regrets that I just can't watch the video. Because I just wish I was like, not, That's like the one big thing. And the one small thing, I can't recall anything else right now. It's probably more.
It sounds like you would do it again. Like the Kickstarter experience overall was positive. Well, you are doing it again.
I am doing it again. Yes. I don't know what we're recording is going to be live. So, but it'll be running for the month of September.
Okay.
And I am launching. I actually, the same thing as before, I'm launching it, earlier than I thought because timing. I'm going to be speaking at DjangoCon US in Austin in early September, and then I'm running a workshop in San Francisco on the book's content in collaboration with Hackwright Academy in the end of September. So I was just like, well, shoot, if I'm going to be running a Kickstarter campaign, I'm already going to be at this conference. I'm already going to be at this like this really big event. I think something like 50 people have signed up for the workshop so far, which is frightening.
Wow, awesome.
So having the Kickstarter out during these two conferences, I'm doing that same tactic again, so I can go run up to people in person and be like, "Yeah, please promote."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you would do Kickstarter again.
Yeah.
Let's keep going now. So, and actually, let's get into a few things that you felt slowed you down, because that's, I think, something all of us makers struggle with is, you know, sometimes we can't ship on time. This book I'm writing, Marketing for Developers, I put on the shelf for a year or something like that. And so what are a few things that happened that delayed the launch?
The biggest thing was that I ran the Kickstarter, and in my Kickstarter description, I said, the money is going to help me take time off of Wedding Lovely and support myself so I can work on the book full time. What actually happened is Wedding Lovely all of a sudden had an investor who wanted to invest. And I was like, oh crap, is this the time? Is this a good time for me to fundraise for Wedding Lovely? Because I never had an investor come to me and like give me money, which was cool, But what happened is that I got like one other small investor, and I spent the summer being like, okay, cool, I'm actually going to fundraise for Wedding Lovely, because it's something I've thought about doing for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
And so instead of spending the summer on working on my book, I spent the summer fundraising instead. And I never actually talked about that publicly because I felt really embarrassed about running a Kickstarter and then not fulfilling that promise to work on it full time. But the opportunity, potential opportunity for Wedding Lovely was too great with this investment. What happened is I completely face planted with fundraising. I went to a billion meetings, and a billion meetings all told me no, but they didn't tell me no immediately. It was over a series of months.
Yeah.
And I ended up stopping fundraising in November after my last no. And then I spent December just like in depression because it was just like fundraising is so hard.
Yeah.
And so like mentally straining. So that vastly slowed down the book during that time. And I regret it. If Wedding Lovely's fundraising was successful, it'd be a better story. But the fact that it failed and then I was delayed on the book was just this awful, period of time.
Yeah. Creator's guilt. I think we get creator's guilt a lot. And the challenge is that on one hand, you want to be able to give people some sort of idea when you're going to be done. with whatever, you know, a new feature for Wedding Lovely, your book, anything. You want to be able to tell people, well, it's not going to happen in 10 years. It's going to happen in this time frame. I think the challenge, especially for us when we're independent, but even teams struggle with this, is stuff happens. And that could be, you know,
especially had a side project, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your real life suddenly wallops you on the face. Like, ah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the vast majority of people are understanding. I think, you know, there's.
Yeah. No one got mad at me. They asked,
well, that's
about,
great.
Like, why was it delayed? And I'd be like, oh, I feel horrible. This is what's happening. And they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, which is nice.
So again, that idea of being honest and, you know, just being straightforward with people.
Well, I wasn't honest about the fundraising. I did have a slew of excuses, but I don't think I ever mentioned the fundraising because it's just like such a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And it, you know, kind of weighs on me now.
You
know, and there's other things that were, that I did talk about that did delay the book. Like one of the things is the fact that I did a actual book as compared to an ebook. It was just, it's just like designer, like in me just had to have a real book because it's too cool to be able to pull it out when I'm being videoed and be like, look at my book. This is so cool. But you know, designing the book, I hadn't done editorial design forever, creating an creating a nice cover, and then printing, I ended up going with a printer in China because they, as compared to one locally, I always want to support local businesses, but the one locally was going to be $10 per book. And if I wanted to sell on Amazon, I would not, I'd be losing money on every book if I was selling that. So this
I've talked to a number of people who have looked into the same thing.
And
right now for printing anything, it's really hard to do anything other than China.
Yeah.
If you actually want to, you know, recoup your costs.
Yeah. But the problem with China is that I worked with Print Ninja. They're amazing. Highly recommend them. The quality is awesome and their support is so great. But you know, unless you pay a ton of more money for air shipping, the books are being shipped on a boat, which takes 2 months. And I had no idea it was going to take 2 months for the prints, for the books to come to me. And apparently there was this whole thing with shipping lane traffic happened during the time, maybe still going on right now, that delayed it further. But I had no idea. That was like a 2 month period I had no idea about. So with this book that I'm working on right now, which should be out by December, I know I have to be completely 100% finished with it with early October in order to reach that. Like I'm aware of those challenges now, which makes it easier.
Yeah. You learned from the process.
It's so much easier when you do it once. You figure out where you failed. It makes things easier that, you know, the second time around. But when you're going into the first, you know, first round, it's a little scary.
So what else did you do for promoting the book? Did you do anything while you were writing it? Did you have a mailing list? Were you still blogging?
The Kickstarter was also huge for building up a mailing list. Before I ran the Kickstarter, I immediately put up a landing page. So I can start collecting email addresses. So both on the Kickstarter side, but then people can also go to the webpage, not, you know, support the Kickstarter, but still give me their email address. I can keep them informed of updates. I think before I ran the Kickstarter, I actually did this a little bit earlier on. I probably had like 100 people on the landing page because I did launch it to like my Twitter followers. Like, I'm writing a book. And then I was able to be like, I'm running a Kickstarter and send that to the small list and kind of watched both of them grow. And then I kept, you know, kept that page up as I was working on the book. So anyone who was asking what I was working on, I'd be like, hey, go to this page and sign up. Total big help. The second huge thing that really helped out in terms of marketing a book, again, by having a physical book, was getting, I'm not going to say professional photos because that's, I did the photos, I'm not a professional, but I took really, I got a preliminary copy of the book printed. It was like with the first draft copy, it was, you know, all the my spelling errors and all my grammar errors and everything. The cover was the only thing that was done, not the spine or the back cover. But I got that done. I, through print on demand, I just got one book printed and then I started taking lovely, beautiful photos of it because it's like, woo, this is a real book. And I put that on the website. And I put it on the Twitter feed because I actually created a Twitter account for Hello Web App so I didn't spam my personal followers with all of my updates. So if someone really wants to know the updates, they can follow this other one. So I put these photos everywhere, which was a huge help because I, you know, I don't think anyone came to me necessarily directly. Like, I love these photos. But when you can see a product that looks real and it looks, you know, especially if my photos, like they're taken with DSLR and they had like the lovely, like fading out background and whatnot. It looked fairly professional. Kind of instills confidence in a project.
Yeah.
People say, oh, this is going to be good quality because the materials surrounding it are good quality.
Yeah. And there's actually two things that I'm going to just pick up on. Because we're talking really about building trust. I think whenever you're selling a product, people want to trust you.
Yeah.
It sounds like you did a couple of things. One is that you didn't just show up one day. You already had been writing blog posts before you decided to do a book. You'd done these tutorials.
Yeah.
You were obviously going to conferences. And I think, you know, having that kind of, a lot of people won't see the long road of content behind somebody, and they assume that the trust was instilled instantaneously. But that's not true. You were doing things beforehand. And then also you were teasing out things that helped people trust you even more. Like, this is going to be a really well put together product.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely helps that I have the skills as a designer, and I kind of have tried to train my design eye to kind of pick up on those things. As helping both with Wedding Lovely and the book, because I don't have to outsource that. I can just, you know, work on it myself. And I know that I can provide a pretty good looking product. And it definitely, I mean, especially for Wedding Lovely too, like having a professional looking website, you know, people are just like, oh, okay. They're more likely to sign up when they see something that's, that visually looks professional. Like, this is a professional service and they'll take care of me, as compared to say, a bad web design where it looks unprofessional, and that will kind of instill in their mind that you could, their interactions and what, you know, what the service is going to be like is going to be unprofessional or, you know, not as great.
The truth is, I think a lot of great products do get launched that don't get noticed just because there's no reach, and the reach comes from people talking about it and sharing it. And a lot of that is on the story, right? Like, the story is interesting when you have some sort of narrative that people can share.
Yeah.
I think,
writing about your experiences, blog posts have been so helpful to me for expanding the amount of, say, Twitter followers I have, which I feel is like a fairly good, like, feel for how big your reach is.
Yeah.
Again, just like being real, talking about my experiences, writing about things that have gone well, writing things that don't go well with Wedding Lovely and the book. I always regret not blogging more. I never regret blogging. It's always, if I haven't blogged in a long time, it's actually worse for my career. Because for a long time with Wedding Lovely, I just went 100% Wedding Lovely. This is before the book. I had to stop blogging altogether. And I think, you know, my connections with people I made before and my ability to make new connections, everything just went stale because I wasn't writing and I wasn't reaching out and trying to expand my network. And I really regret that period of time because I kind of, I knew some really cool people in the Bay Area and I just lost complete connection with them. And so when I was launching these new products, I was like, why didn't I continue this? Like, it was a huge regret.
Yeah. Now I'm going to forget his name. Is it Gabe Weinberg? He suggests 50-50, 50% product development, 50% kind of blogging, marketing, networking, that kind of stuff. And
it's,
I think that's
exhausting, but yeah, necessary.
Yeah, I think it's a good mix.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next for Wedding Lovely? What are your plans for that? Are you going to keep working on it?
Yeah, continue working on it. Like I said, it's not a runaway success. I tried fundraising, it didn't work out, but it kind of runs itself because the way I've built the company, vendors join my vendor directory. They send out an email to be approved. I can just approve it pretty easily. And then there's a whole slew of automated systems that kind of take care of sending emails and welcome emails and getting them started. And then I have a planning app, pretty much the same thing. And so it kind of runs without my involvement, which is awesome for when I need to take time off to work on the book. But things always improve when I jump back into it and I work on it full time. Right now, my biggest thing is how do I improve? Because Wedding Lovely, I run, is like both a planning guide to walk people through wedding planning, but I also have a public facing vendor directory where I try to showcase awesome small business, local vendors near a person. And my biggest thing right now I'm working on is actually how to improve those results, which has been really fun because I, you know, before building web app, I just like display information. That's all I was focused on for, you know, first 3 years or so of working at Wedding Lovely. But now I'm looking on how to improve information. And then I actually was working last night on an algorithm for ranking vendors in terms of their quality based on factors on their profile. But then I also have to pull that into the search results when it's, you know, you're trying right now, search results are ordered by just location, where it's like closest, next closest, next closest. Yeah. But when I have a ranking for these vendors, how do I update that location search? So it's not necessarily by location, but it's still relevant to them. But then the best vendors float to the top. So this is where the computer science stuff, I think that if I had that degree, there'd be a lot more stuff I would know at this point and how to do that kind of algorithmic type stuff.
Yeah.
Which is a little frustrating, but it's fun.
Yeah. Well, now you actually have that first platform built.
Yeah.
So yeah, it might be a challenge to build that next piece, but now at least you have that first part built. You've got something running that people are using.
And that's what I say with the book, is that you don't need a computer science degree to get that first part out. Just to get a web app out and start accumulating information. It's really simple. You don't need crazy theory, computer science, engineering type stuff in your web app. And just like me, people can learn it as they go.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's awesome. I think that's a good place to leave it, Tracy. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been really fun.
All right, folks, that's it for this week. I just realized listening back to that track that I was bumping my microphone a ton during that interview. I'm really sorry about that. Hopefully it did not drive you crazy. I'm going to make sure that I adjust this mic setup so that doesn't happen again. Please go and follow Tracy on Twitter at LimeDaring. You can also follow me. I'm at MIJustin. And check out Tracy's projects as well. HelloWebApp.com. She's in the midst of her new Kickstarter. HelloWebApp.com/Kickstarter. All right. I'll see you next time. I've got a few more interviews in the bag that are going to be coming out in the next probably 3 weeks. So keep an eye on that. And also go check out justinjackson.ca/marketingfordevelopers. The final version, the big launch, is coming up in October. Talk to you soon.